domestic consumption is what has been driving the economy, and that slowing down is a matter of great concern. I mean, 70% of iPhones sold in India are on debt. This is not anywhere in the world, you know, that does this happen. So the problem is that we are living out of tomorrow's income.
India is much higher on, or have a we are leaning weight on private consumption as compared to China. We are starting to see that premium brands are starting to have higher growth as compared to the traditional ones or the mass brands.
Wealth is either getting generated in real estate or in stocks. Gold also has done dramatically well, because if you see gold, it has doubled pre-pandemic to now.
IT jobs in 2003, 4, 5, a Wipro, TCS, Infosys would hire at 3.5 lakhs, between 2.5 to 3 lakhs a year. Today, the same role is at around 3 to 3.5 lakhs per year. It's still the same, right?
I've been hearing India is the next China for the last 15 years. Everybody still tells me that the next 15 years, India will become the next China, right? Do you think this is possible?
So they say that economists, you know, are there only to make weather forecasters look good.
Folks, welcome to episode 3 of Asymmetric. Today we have an extremely special guest, someone who's become very comfortable with podcasts, and I would like to take some credit for it. Aseem, welcome. You joined the bandwagon with Revan, Chirag and me on this very early Saturday morning. Chirag, we have accommodated a 7 a.m. start because of your flight. But Aseem, thank you for being kind. But given you had told me that you wake up at 4 o'clock, we're like, okay, fine. 7 is kind of midday for you, around lunchtime. But welcome to Asymmetric.
Thank you. Thank you, Shantanu. I look forward to an engaging conversation. This is a great format. We'll have fun.
Awesome. CT, Revant, over to you guys.
No, yeah, good to see all of you on a Saturday morning. I actually was going to thank you, Shantanu, for making sure that I see a sunrise on Saturday morning as well. But I think my, at least, Twitter timeline, or sorry, X timeline, is now filled with the most important news that came out yesterday, which is the GDP numbers for the last quarter. And I think we've been hearing this from a lot of quarters, that demand has slowed down, consumption has slowed down, etc. But I think the numbers sort of plummeting every quarter for the last 4 quarters seems to be now quite concerning to see. I would love to sort of get a deep dive as to why this is happening and what's the next steps going to be. So if you see the last 4 quarters, isn't it concerning that, I mean, it seems to be quite consistently dropping, right? It doesn't seem to be a one-off. What was more interesting for me to see in this was, like, you know, when we look at our GDP, 65% is consumption-led. And there seems to be a stark drop more around that, because there is some, I mean, there's manufacturing drop, there's consumption drop. What has sustained is actually the government expenditure.
Spending.
Yeah, government spending. And I think US saw a similar thing in the last couple of years, right? Where government spending technically was, whatever growth was coming in the GDP was largely because of government spending. And if you remove government spending, actually they had negative GDP. So if you remove the government spending part, is that a fair way to look at it, Aseem? That, you know, government expenditure is artificially propping up the GDP as well?
So see, the GDP comprises of 3 or 4 components. One is a private consumption. Second is the government consumption. Third is domestic investments. And fourth is net exports, exports minus imports, you know, net exports. So if you look in India's case, what has happened over the last few years consistently, and this has been a trend before COVID as well, that you had a private consumption that was that was steady. Government consumption was what was really driving growth over the last decade. You know, we have seen that corporate capex has come down completely. So there's been very little brownfield, greenfield investments. And we have been largely reliant on private consumption to move the needle up. And then exports haven't really moved much, but imports have come off. You know, so if effectively the net export minus import, we are still on the way balanced. So effectively, you know, what is happening is that of all the components that are there, and the fourth component is private savings, that also has come off of late. So you know, when you add all the components together, 65%, you know, with the domestic consumption is what has been driving the economy, and that slowing down is a matter of great concern. So now we are already spending 10 trillion rupees on infrastructure in the budget. More is not possible. So at the moment, without upsetting the fiscal balance. So you know, considering everything now, we are at a slightly concerning situation. But if you look at it on the longer tenure, this is where we were pre-COVID. Then COVID created a little bit of an anomaly where savings went up to 16%. Net savings of Indian consumers went up from 10% to 16%. So to that extent, there was a pent-up demand that came into the economy the next few years. So post-COVID, there has been a smart recovery on GDP. Now we are actually back to our pre-COVID trend growth.
Aseem, are we saying that that's the normal level for our country and then, you know, we have bumped it up by this artificial pent-up demand due to COVID, which is now starting to taper and come to, like, there is a mean reversion which is happening?
So see, one of the engines of growth that we were looking, because we had become a largely services driven economy, and manufacturing was a cause of concern. There has been a lot of talk of manufacturing now coming back in India, because ultimately to generate the jobs that we need and to ensure that we get the right amount of GDP lift, we need manufacturing. We cannot not have manufacturing. But if you look at this print of this latest GDP number, the manufacturing also has been extremely less. So effectively, what we are seeing is that if you see agriculture, which is what is going to be steady, it is in fact agriculture has actually been the only silver spur in this number. So if you look at agriculture, we can't see growth there. Services, we've already seen a good growth there. More growth on that is going to be difficult. Then there is manufacturing, which is not picking up. Unless manufacturing picks up, getting beyond the 6% trend growth is going to be tough.
I'll just share one more chart, which I think Aseem was referring. This is, you know, our net financial savings and see how they've dropped. You know, we are probably around the lowest level in terms of financial savings per household, which is quite concerning.
Yeah, I think a lot of commentary, Aseem, and I love the way you put it on the WhatsApp group also, saying that there is a symptom and then there is an underlying cause. But one of the symptoms, and we are still discussing those, I think one of the symptoms which for me hit, and maybe for our viewers also, is what does it mean for me, right? And household balance sheet health. And savings, as Chirag's chart shows, is something that kind of affects all of us. And I think a lot of us will resonate with this at a personal level. But what does this mean? Like, is this one of those symptoms that starts becoming a separate disease of its own? Because these are kind of conditioning and habitual things that take time to shake off.
So actually, if you see and to understand this chart better, when we are saying, has Indian savings really dropped? The answer is yes and no. It has not dropped in the sense that the actual gross savings have been steady. So there has been no drop in gross savings that Indian consumers are doing. So it's not that people have just started to spend more. It is just that if you take a little step back, saying how did we get here? I would say there are four reasons why we have got here. The first is that there has been a dollarization of cost in India. So what has happened is that, we have been started consuming things which are priced in US dollars. So right from starting for an iPhone to a laptop to your coffee at Starbucks, to your movie experience. Now, where my office is, there used to be a single theater there called Sangam. At that theater, the ticket prices were 50 rupees. Then it became Carnival and became a slightly upgraded experience. The ticket prices moved to 150 rupees. And now PVR has come there. The ticket prices have gone up to 350 to 500 rupees. And a bag of popcorn now costs in US dollars as much as it would cost in US. So effectively what has happened is that the expenditure has gone up. Inflation has been roaring. And if you actually take healthcare and education, two places where the inflation is not, number is not actually getting captured. Because the inflation in India is calculated on a basket of goods and services that no longer most Indians consume. It is slightly outdated because it is more towards food. And therefore, now food, as your economy lifts, food becomes a smaller component of the overall portion of actual spend, and other components take over. So inflation has hurt quite a bit. Then you have got government, when it spends, where does it spend from? So one is taxation and the other is deficit financing. Now we've had a rise in both. The individual personal taxation has almost doubled over the last 3-4 years, and that is because the tax rates also have gone up substantially. So now at the top level, the Indian consumer pays 43% gross tax versus 25% post expenditure that a corporate pays. So therefore, we are seeing that the corporate tax has been flat. The individual tax collection is going up. GST is always inflationary. Everywhere in the world where GST has been implemented, it has caused inflation. So GST is always inflationary, and everything in India becomes 18 to 20% more expensive just by the virtue of GST. And this is reflective of the collection that we are seeing. Third is that the fuel, if you actually look at tax collection on fuel, as the fuel prices have dropped, the pump prices haven't dropped. So the government tax collection on fuel, has been also substantially rising. Now, what all of this is doing is that income is not keeping pace. So if income is not keeping pace, your expenditure is going up. Consumers turn to loans to finance their needs. So if you actually see, India is in a very curious situation that normally what happens is that personal loans are driven by mortgage loans, like what happens in the US, that except for a $2 trillion student loan that they have, which is unique to their system. Generally, mortgages is what drives, and then in US, there is credit card. These two things that drives their personal loans. In India, actually, if you see in the last 4 years, amazing change has happened where non-mortgage loans have actually outpaced personal loans and mortgage loans. And what this has done is that it has created a situation where the debt service ratio of the Indian consumer has now gone up to almost 12%, which is what is there in Nordic countries. So we are at a debt service ratio. The Indian consumer is more leveraged than the US consumer, UK consumer, or the Chinese consumer. So
that's insane. I think, what is debt service ratio, just before, how would you define that for the layperson?
So basically, it is the amount of EMIs you are paying for the level of income that you have. So so that is a level of concern that has built up. And then when government does deficit financing, effectively it is future taxation. So all deficit financing is taxation, and that also will ultimately come on to the retail consumers. Incomes haven't people turn to debt, and as people turn to debt, the disposable income keeps coming down. So now you have got an absolute income that you earn, then you have a tax rate which is high, then you have debt servicing that you already have to do. Now 70% of iPhones sold in India are on debt. This is not anywhere in the world, that does this happen. So the problem is that we are living out of tomorrow's income, and that has created this situation where the Indian consumer now is fairly levered. Now, when this situation happens, effectively your ability to consume drops. So you will ultimately cut down. You'll have to pay your past EMIs. You'll have to cut down. Secondly, what is not appreciated much is the amount of impact that the interest rate increase has had on the Indian consumer. So that 250 basis point repo increase that was done post-COVID. To give you a context, if you had a 20 lakh home loan and for a 40 lakh home loan for 20 years, and a 2.5% increase will basically mean that to keep the EMI same, your loan will go from 20 years to almost 32 to 33 years. Just imagine the impact that this would have. So what it would basically mean is that your interest and outgo would go up from 35 lakhs, what it would have originally been, to almost about 79 to 80 lakhs of interest outgo that you would pay. And if the EMI increases, the EMI increases by almost 40%. So both ways, the pain is high. So and in India, the real challenge is that most of our debt is high interest rate and low tenure. When tenures are long, the DSCR impact is lesser. DSCR impact becomes much higher when tenures come down. So effect to sum it up, we have a situation where debt-fueled growth, debt-fueled consumption growth has now reached its maximum limit. Government spending has now reached its maximum limit. So from here, incomes need to rise, which is a very, very painful thing.
Interesting. Asim, I want to pick up a few things which you said, I think, at the beginning. And then, I was showing some charts that how food inflation versus normal inflation is quite high. Similarly, we have seen residential prices go up. But I wanted to pick up the private consumption part, right, which is the predominant part of, let's say, our GDP. I'll pull up a few charts and make my point. So this is from our famous Indus Valley report, which shows that India is much, much higher on or have a leaning weight on private consumption as compared to China. And if that's the case, I wanted to double down on that, okay, if, this is the predominant factor, which, while everyone has been saying, okay, can government spends go up, can gross capital fixed formation go up? It hasn't, right? And it takes time. The immediate thing is what you are also saying, either incomes go up or incomes leading to private consumption goes up, right? And if I go deeper into it, I'll go to, what we keep referring to, the India 1-2-3. We use this terminology of India 1-2-3, which is, some people say 100 million population, etc. There are various different estimates, but I just did some maths that how much of private consumption comes from India 1-2-3. And, some broad math basis, some household expenditures, this is what it boils down to, right? Wherein India 1 is almost like 45% contribution, whereas 55% is India 2-3, right? And if that's the case, and if I go deeper, you'll see that, India 1 seems to be growing. So this is population, which is almost India 1. They are expected to become big. And, I'll show you some interesting charts. So these are different companies in different, categorized by mass brands or premium brands. We are starting to see that premium brands are starting to, have higher growth as compared to the traditional ones or the mass brands. And by the way, this is reflective in today's quarters also. This is a little dated report, but I'll show you some of the things. Yeah, this is revenue growth September 24 versus 23. Look at all the left ones. So hotels is where India 1 spends. Make My Trip is where India 1 spends. Titan, DreamFox. Whereas on the right side, you have mass brands, Unilever, Dabur, Barbecue Nation, Domino's. There you see muted growth. So the point which I was getting to is that, and this is Jubilant Foods. The point which I was getting to is that, are we seeing a different India 1-2-3 behavior? Which we should be discussing, that while India 1 continues to spend, India 2-3 is facing more heat of economy cooling down, wages not rising, or is it across? What's your view there?
See, the problem with statistics in India specifically is that it is about that you can drown in an average 3 feet of water. So the average is where the problem lies. That if you take any states, like one of the states, for example, that we are now going fairly deep in is Bihar. Now, let's understand what are the dynamics of that state. And more or less every Indian state is like this. So, it's not that Bihar is an exception. So if you look at Bihar, how many families are there in Bihar? There are about 2.8 crore families that live in the state. So that's the total population size of India 1-2-3 that you have. Now, if you dissect it, 94 lakh families earn less than 6,000 rupees a month. I'll let that sink in. 200 rupees a day, 6,000 rupees a month. The entire family income of 94 lakh family is at that level. Then you say, okay, how many people earn between 6,000 to 10,000? That's another 80 lakh families. Now, at what level do you really have disposable consumption income? You would say that Probably. I mean, in the disposable income really starts when you start earning at least 50,000 rupees a month. That's when some of the consumption, you know, is possible given the current prices. Only about 3.5% of Bihar, you know, which is 3.5% of 3 crores. So about 10 lakh families have actually an income of more than 50,000 rupees a month. So the challenge becomes that how do you see this reflecting in the banking system? That the pain right now is the highest in the microfinance industry. So microfinance is actually the one that goes to that below 10,000 rupees a month income stream. And they get, you know, these loans. So effectively what is happening is that they are the ones getting affected the most. And the pain is highest in the microfinance industry. Then the pain moves up, you know, into the unsecured space. But primarily, again, you will see that it is only the higher risk lenders that are seeing the pain. The top premier prime segment of unsecured is behaving quite okay. So effectively, what is happening is that this middle segment of India, middle and lower segment of India, the India 2 and 3, is what really was living on borrowed income, which has now come under stress. And while inequalities of income have always been a reality across the world, pandemic actually created a greater disturbance in this. So one of the post-pandemic impacts that has been not appreciated as much is the inequality that has happened. That, I mean, if you see India, almost 2,000 to 2,500 families have made out like bandits in the pandemic, you know, especially the, you know, people who had, you know. So now today, where is the wealth getting generated? Wealth is either getting generated in real estate or in stocks. Gold also has done dramatically well, because if you see gold, it has doubled pre-pandemic to now. It's actually doubled. One is the dollar doubling, and second is the rupee dollar impact also helping along the way. So effectively, what we are seeing is that those who have wealth have multiplied it many times. Those who were living only on income, you know, have actually ended up taking debt. So the dichotomy now is that if this continues, you know, we will see even a wider gap between India 1 and India 3 emerge, you know, and that is that's a challenge that we have to solve. And at the root of this is productivity. That our labor factor productivity is probably one of the lowest in the world. I mean, to give you an idea, India has probably 2.5 lakh factories at the latest estimate. China has almost 28 million factories in China. Now, if you see, this 28 million factories absorb about 83 million Chinese workers. And in India, these 2.5 lakh factories have got almost 35 to 40 lakh, workers. So effectively, what it tells you is that the productivity difference between the Indian worker and the Chinese worker is 4:1. Now, that is a huge problem. Now, when you have productivity which is so low, your wages will also reflect the same. So then, you know, you've got a lot of people, that when there is too much supply and little skill, the pricing ability and capital gets misallocated. So, for example, earlier in India, the largest growing jobs and the fastest growing jobs were the IT jobs, which were decently paying and with reasonable ability to rise for people, you know, post their coming in. Now we are creating gig economy jobs. Now, do we really need more deliveries to happen? But reality is that the kind of people that are there and the kind of salaries that you can pay, you know, to these people, you are able to create this gig economy. And given the density of population in India, this kind of delivery, you know, mechanisms are possible. So effectively, we are creating again jobs which are low skilled, etc. And then these people, you know, see, ultimately, almost 80% of India earns less than 20,000 rupees a month. And that is not at a level where consumption can happen. So we have got, unless we solve the problem of skilling the people right, you know, and getting the productivity right, we are caught in this middle income trap, you know, that this $2,500 per capita that we are finding it difficult to break out of.
Interesting.
A very valid point. And I keep thinking about this, that when we started Bombay Shaving Company 8-9 years back, our delivery cost or the cost, the average salary of a delivery boy in an e-commerce company was roughly 15 to 19,000 rupees a month. It is literally exactly the same amount even today. We spoke about IT jobs. In 2003, 4, 5, a Wipro, TCS, Infosys would hire at 3.5 lakhs, between 2.5 to 3 lakhs a year. Today, the same role is at around 3 to 3.5 lakhs per year. It's still the same, right? So, it actually boils down to income increasing and at a higher skill level. And if we are going to bet it on manufacturing, then the current baselines don't work. And if all of that put together, incomes continue to remain flat, but taxation goes up, hence inflation goes up, hence spending goes down, saving goes down, but we can't leverage more. So then we get stuck. So I don't know what is the way out, because it seems to be a hole that is significantly deeper than one can imagine.
Very interesting. I think, Aseem, you made points around, there is pain in microfinance, high risk lending happening, and there are a lot of defaults happening there. I'll go back to, what it means is that India 2-3 is definitely seeing pain. And let's say, we love to discuss second order effects here. So what does it mean going forward from here? One is that, okay, can you upskill? Can you get India 2-3 to earn more? That's one leg. And the second leg is India 1 seems to be doing well. They are growing. What does it mean for companies, businesses which are serving India 1? Are they well off? At least the data indicates that they are doing well. They continue, or at least that's the segment which is resilient, continues to spend on travel, on discretionary spending. Is there concern for those segments also short term? I think long term, we all agree that all of this is, our growth is secular. I think we should separate the two discussions, that what does it mean for India 1 and then India 2-3 as well. Because we are seeing a lot of different data, example being, one very tactical thing. India has caught on to this Black Friday thing. Yesterday it kicked off, and from our point of view, we saw the highest ever day yesterday. And I'm expecting that this to continue over the next 10 days, which is predominantly India 1 behavior, right? So they are all spending discretionary money on shopping and other things. We are going to see some travel numbers. I saw that India had, I think Shantanu was mentioning, India did 5 crore passenger flights in a day, somewhat that number. So that has become the highest. So it clearly shows that India 1 is thriving, is more resilient, is, companies which are focusing on that, should they continue to execute? They are like inert to the economic turmoil or downturn which is happening. India 2-3 is more of a concern.
Just to give you one more point, Aseem, before you hold your thought, Chirag, did you know, I remember when you were out at BSC, we used to keep discussing iOS is a very small part, Android is a bulk, iOS is small, Android is a bulk. A data point that blew my mind is that Apple India revenue is bigger than HUL revenue now.
Yeah, I have that chart also, which was...
I could not believe it. And because Apple India is not listed, it's like kind of flies under the radar. We keep thinking it's only 2% and 3% of mobile share and all that. But Apple India revenue being bigger than HUL blows my mind. It blows my mind. Sorry, Aseem, I cut you off. Sorry.
Similarly, Aseem, I'll add one more chart here. So these are United Spirits, all mass brands versus, look at all the prestigious brands. Or premium brands, look at the difference in growth.
So, Ismena, I think, Chirag, while you are mentioning this, I think it's time we revise the definitions of India 1, 2, and 3. If this chart, right, or if you mentioned Apple, right, I think Apple now used to be struggling at 2, 3, now it's almost 7-8% of all mobile phones
in India.
In India, right? I don't think if you take 100 million people in India 1, which is, let's take Aseem's barrier of 50,000 rupees per month. I don't think they're consuming these premium brands that you're talking about. I think it's like almost India 0.1 needs a definition, which would be like 2 lakh rupees per month household income. And I think that base would be like maybe 10 million, 20 million people, which is where I think all of these data points are coming up? Because the premium brands, and correct me if I'm wrong, Azim, that I mean, some of it would be fueled. I think the India one, even the taking the iPhone on EMI is still an India one behavior. India two cannot afford, they'll not get the EMI itself. So if you take the top 20 million, they have saved up, like Azim said, in the K-shaped recovery in COVID, largely wealth gap increase, and the India 0.1, which was 30 million people that shops on D2C, Chirag, for your reference, and is participating in the Black Friday sales, and you're seeing highest ever sales across, is that 30 million folks. And the rest, next 70 million, which comprises, that's where India one, I think, broadly exists, is still buying on EMIs and stuff, which is where the pain is now coming in. Because a lot of those, that consumption, which is the 50,000 to 1 lakh rupee household income folks, also have started spending beyond their means using personal loans, EMIs and credit cards. Is that a fair hypothesis, Asi?
See, aspirations always exceed reality. And the what we are seeing in India is that one of the behavioral changes of generation to generation that has happened is that earlier the India 2 behaved as India 2 and India 3 behaved as India 3 and were happy within that or contained within that. Now, India 2 and India 3 also want what India 1 wants. So, at one end, we have premiumization of brands happening where everybody wants it. Today, for example, Maruti 800, which is Alto now, is struggling. But the Mercedes-Benz is doing very well, thank you. India now, one out of two cars is an SUV. And now entry-level car, which used to be a 300,000 rupee car, has now moved to an 700,000 to 800,000 rupee cars. You know, so effectively, the entry-level cars have also gone up. This is also reflecting in every brand that people purchase. So now that 70% iPhone sold on EMI is basically telling you that India 2 and some India 3, which couldn't have afforded, has also aspired for it. And because the numbers are so large, even a very small percentage moving it moves the needle dramatically. So one is that on one end, there is premiumization of brand happening and the basic brands are not selling because beyond the point, see, at some point of time, Colgate was replacing tooth powders. So until that was there, there was a different kind of a growth that happened. Now that has got saturated. It is toothpaste have reached everywhere that they needed to reach. Now, the only story can be about premiumization from here, that as people move up and aspire and move up from one brand to another and go down. So, one is that the shopping patterns have changed. So, see, we are a country where there are 13 million Kirana shops. I mean, can you even imagine the number? There are 13 million Kirana shops. There are almost about 6.5 lakh beauty salons across the country. There are 100,000 plus chemist shops across the country. Now what is happening is that the shopping pattern is changing. So there are a few duopolies and monopolies that are getting created, which are ordering things home. And ultimately, the consumption basket is not changing. So while you had Kirana shops, then you had the organized retail, come in. And even before the organized retail, could really make a big dent, you have these quick commerce companies coming and changing the behavioral pattern of purchase. The same thing is playing out across. So your taxi driver now becomes an Uber driver because that is how that business has evolved. Your people who are giving services come through companies like Urban Clap, etc. And tap that market. So effectively, what has happened is that the and whenever there is a middle guy, your cost goes up. So every quick commerce company, every food delivery company is pushing cost up by 15% to 25% of the base price. So effectively, that also is a form of inflation that is going down the street. So eating out, for example, was something that was very rarely done at some point of time. Now is it is done quite often, or ordering in is replacing eating out to some level. Now what we are seeing is that every level as it aspires consumes this. When it can't consume it with income, it tries to consume it with debt. Because even if you look at credit card numbers in India, credit card outstandings, are now crossing 300,000, so 3 trillion rupees, which basically is it. What the number used to be, less than a trillion, about 4 or 5 years back. So you can see that the levels of debt, it is fueling these levels of consumption. And while there is a genuine struggle at India 3, India 2 does seem to be using debt to fuel aspirational consumption.
Wow. Got it. One piece that I keep seeing, because we are, you know, part of a lot of venture communities and founder communities, is how everyone believes that overall incomes will rise over the next 20 years, right? Like the number of people who are in the high income group will go from, let's say, 50 million to 400 million by 2047, right? A lot of the upper middle, which is about 400 million people, will go to a billion people, right? This is people who earn between 50,000 to, I think, 3 lakh per se. And an interesting part I thought in this is, while it's great to think about this happening, fundamentally, I think we all miss that the biggest shocker for me was the fact that the GDP is at 5% and the inflation is at 6%. Now, of course, it's the real GDP. I mean, there's a nominal GDP and a real GDP, so there is some gap there. But fundamentally, as incomes rise, if the inflationary aspect, and you mentioned this in the beginning, where GST has added, I mean, the income tax rates have effectively, the taxation on the income tax paying class is just phenomenally high, right? And we are actually very close to developed nations without actually having the infrastructure that developed nations have, at least even for the income tax paying population. So while incomes continue to grow, let's assume that incomes grow for a moment, because we are saying that, hey, income has to grow. But let's assume that incomes grow and we figure out a way to grow the incomes. Do we think that at 6% inflation, that income growth is still going to help us increase consumption, or the basket will change? I don't think that's going to happen.
So see, India has always been a inflationary economy, and we've always had inflation at a slightly higher level. And to some extent, we actually need the inflation. So, you know, if the inflation goes too low, you know, that also is a cause of concern. Now, if you actually see the inflation basket right now, the only thing that is a concern is the food inflation. So apart from food inflation, you know, the rest of the inflation, you know, it is not that we are living in inflationary times at this moment. So the rest of the inflation is not really affecting that much. Mainly the component of food is what is driving the inflation numbers, headline inflation numbers that we see, which is why the clamoring by the system, saying that RBI needs to reduce rates, because you know, food, there have been various studies done which tells you that you know, repo rates, you know, have nothing to do with food inflation and don't affect it in any way. So on one side, we have fiscal loosening, you know, that has happened, you know, by the government. The other side, there is an extreme monetary tightening, you know, that has happened, you know, by RBI, where right now, you know, what is probably needed, in my opinion, is one is a CRR cut, which basically will allow some more money to come into the economy. Second is that the dollar, you know, is being allowed to strengthen too much, you know, at the moment. So there is a need to probably sell dollars and buy rupees, you know, and as well, you know, to ensure that we don't start importing inflation, you know, through this, you know, considering fuel is a very big component. You know, third is, you know, that probably the economy numbers are suggesting that a rate cut is now imminent, and we should get it, if not now, you know, by February, you know, we should get the rate cut going. So effectively, what happens is that the economy needs to be, you know, needs to be kept well lubricated to ensure that money flows, because ultimately it's the velocity of money, you know, that drives growth. And
could you explain that, Aseem, for our audience? I think the dollar INR depreciation is very clear, because we import so much, and as dollar INR keeps increasing, our imports become more expensive. So we are importing inflation as well, right? So, and actually, I don't think a lot of our audience would also know how RBI can control rates, in terms of, you know, what can RBI do to effectively keep the dollar INR at a more steady state, or maybe actually even improve it compared to where it's going. And second, how does CRR and money flow, the lubrication you talked about, how does that actually help the economy? Maybe some of those nuances if it could be explained for our audience.
And Asim, just to add, I've pulled out this chart also, which says that what is RBI doing at the moment. I think it will help you explain the context that what is RBI trying to do with respect to buying dollars. And does it add fuel inflation, to make your point?
So the Reserve Bank of India has the following jobs. At one level, it has to manage the monetary policy of the country. And monetary of the policy of the country is primarily interest rates, that the economy needs to have. The idea is to keep the interest rate at either what is a real level. Real level is what is the inflation plus number. So if, for example, right now, the inflation is 6%, and you have got repo rate which are 6.5%. It is effectively telling you that we are at a positive scenario. Sometimes it dips below when we are at a negative scenario. So real estate, interest rates are kept positive, which basically is signaling to the economy that which way the interest rate needs to go. Now, it's a counter-cyclical weight that RBI does. When the economy growth falls, at that point of time, people bring into measure, monetary authorities cut rates. When rates are cut, you have got, people's ability to borrow goes up. So, for example, if I'm running a factory I want to put up a new factory, there is a, over a 10-year loan or a 5-year loan that I take, the difference of 1% can be a difference between my deciding to put up the factory or not put up the factory. So the impact is that it allows me to take a decision to put up the factory if interest rates are low. When interest rate becomes too low, capital gets misallocated, which is what happened in the US, that when interest rate went down to zero, then all assets became risk-free. So effectively, people started taking punts into all kinds of things, which otherwise in their sanity, they would have never done because money became free. And when money becomes free, risks also become freely taken. So bitcoins, and then you have all kinds of NFTs and all kinds of stuff, taking off.
All of us benefited. All the venture as asset class ballooned massively in that period as well. Yeah,
correct. And all this cash burn, the word cash burn was possible only because of 0% interest rate. Yeah. So when money becomes expensive, all these goes out of the window. So when rates are cut, people's ability to spend the money goes up, to consume goes up. Even when you're taking a home loan, there's a big difference between, for example, when you look at eligibility, banks will look at your salary to your installment. And, the 1% difference in interest rate will basically mean that instead of buying a 2 BHK house, now you can buy a 3 BHK house. So it's a huge impact that happens over a 20-year lifestyle that you don't really realize. So people are able to uptrade given the same amount of money that they have. They're able to extend that EMI if the interest rates are lower. What it does is that the demand and consumption goes up. It's an economy's moving cycle. When too much loosening of monetary policies happen, you get inflation coming in. Because inflation is nothing but demand exceeding supply. Too much money chasing too few goods, the classical definition. When that happens, you've got demand going up, inflation moves up. When inflation moves up, RBI then moves the other way and will increase interest rates to cut down demand. And when, which is what it did post-COVID, when it saw, that when it had cut rates during COVID, post-COVID, it moved interest rate up, in order to curtail inflation. Because government spending had gone up, and when government spending goes up, it creates inflation in the economy. So one is the fiscal, side. Government controls the fiscal side. The finance ministry and the amount they spend control the fiscal side. The other is the monetary side, where rates are managed. Second is that RBI also acts as a central banker to the nation. So the government's borrowing plans, are handled by the regulator. So that's the second job. The third is to manage forex volatility. So RBI stated policies that they do not seek a particular rupee dollar rate, but they seek to curtail volatility in that moment. The way it does it is by either buying dollars or selling dollars. When too much dollars were coming in and the rupee was looking to appreciate, RBI started selling dollars to keep that in control. So and it does the reverse, when the rupee dollar moves the other way. So right now, for example, RBI can sell dollars and buy rupees, which will basically mean that rupee will strengthen and the dollar will weaken. So that is the outcome that that they seek. All of this is actually very difficult to achieve in real life. Because one is that every time you, for example, if you buy dollars and sell rupees, then you have a situation of too much rupees floating into the system, which basically again causes inflation. So the balancing between inflation, interest rate, and growth are the three difficult things that the regulator seeks to achieve. And in this, right now, for example, the RBI is more focused on inflation, which is why it is saying we will not cut rates. But the growth print is suffering. So the minute they cut rates, the growth print starts to increase. So we know that capitalism is broken because the modern monetary theory has made a mess of all Keynesian and Miltonian economics that we have been taught. So I don't even know what economics professors teach these days because every single classical economic theory has gone out of the window. So now the reality is that the deficit financing is real across the world. To that extent, India has done a good job maintaining the fiscal discipline, which it could have very easily given up in COVID. So we are in a good fiscal space. The regulator, probably will loosen monetary policy given the current growth rate, which will mean that the loans will become cheaper and consumption, can then come back because affordability of things then go up.
One question I had, Aseem, if you're saying that RBI's current focus is to manage inflation and a key aspect of inflation is 30% of inflation, 30% of our GDP is contributed by imports. That was the chart that you were showing, right? So there's a negative 30% on the component in the GDP growth on imports. So the more we import, the more expensive imports become, the slower the GDP is, right? And we also discussed that USD appreciating is a problem because the imports become more expensive, actually hurts our potential growth as our GDP numbers as well. Why would RBI continue to buy dollars today? We have a massive reserve, I think north of $700-800 billion in currency reserves. Why would we not start selling dollars to just keep the rates? I mean, there is no reason for this. It's inching towards 85 now, and it's actually on a tear in the last couple of months. It's actually very flummoxing as to why RBI is doing that right now and not actually selling dollars and actually getting the rates down, because that will effectively help curb inflation as well, right? And help the GDP growth.
So see, you have to look at the broader context in which dollar is behaving. So since Trump has come back, the general theory is that dollar will strengthen. So dollar has been strengthening across all currencies. And there is a possibility, considering the way things are going, that the Chinese may actually end up depreciating yen. Depreciating renminbi. So the Chinese may actually end up depreciating their currency, which will make our exports that much more difficult to achieve. So one is that a strong dollar hurts imports, a strong dollar also helps exports. So somewhere, what is the ideal rupee dollar rate is always open to.
So your view is, let's work on increasing exports rather, because in the end you're going to earn more for the same.
Also, we have to see that at this point of time, FIIs are selling. So you got money moving out of the country through that route, and FDI has not really been coming in to the level that it used to come in. So with a situation that you've got you've got your reasonable balance between import and export right now, trade deficit is not a concern. In a situation where you have money moving out of the country higher than the money coming into the country, in this situation, one good thing is that to a great extent, Whatever is our import of oil is getting balanced out with our export of software, which is now over $200 billion. And to a great extent, that $100 billion plus inflow, the remittances that Indians send home, is also counterbalancing. So at the moment, I think the regulator, is also watchful of the overall dollar movement that is happening across the world, because we don't, operate in isolation. But in the long run, I think, rupee should be, appreciated. And we now are comfortable on the forex front in terms of reserves. So there is a case of at the moment, selling dollars and infusing more rupee into the system, which is possibly what they are likely to do.
I think that's the long view, right, Revan, which is you kind of focus on manufacturing. Hopefully, the import-export ratio kind of goes down because you start selling to the world, more dollars come in, income also goes up because talent starts migrating towards manufacturing over a period of time. And that kind of solves for growth and inequity both at the same time. But I just find it difficult to kind of see the short-term advantages of that, because end of the day, inflation increasing, government spending, I think largely because of government spending, and then hence, it always looks like a band-aid on a fracture situation. So short-term, it always feels like pain. And I don't know whether that's just the price one has to pay for this kind of growth or, kind of the long-term view.
Actually, maybe it's in my head, but it's almost like it's cyclical, right? Like you just mentioned, FIIs are pulling money out of the Indian market. Chirag has this chart up, right? That whenever there's some extreme event, FIIs start pulling money out of the market. I don't know whether it's Trump's win or India's general slowdown, because there's been an earnings slowdown clearly in the Nifty stocks. That's visible. I don't know what the precise reason is, but it almost seems cyclical. If it is the consumption slowdown, it's almost like, consumption slowdown is there, earnings aren't great, FIIs are pulling out. Effectively, then there's the dollar rupee goes for a toss. Again, it has to be managed. Imports become more expensive. People have inflation goes up. It's almost like everything leads to one thing leads to other. And now I understand why when you're saying that it's a delicate balance that has to be managed. There are too many data points. And we don't even know what data points the RBI or the government is actually optimizing for. Because we are only discussing what is available in the public, right? Maybe it's also a little, I was never good at economics or math. So, Saturday, subeh, it's almost like thoda sa lecture ho raha hai aur main samajhne try kar raha hu ki exam mein pass kaise honge.
So, they say that economists, are there only to make weather forecasters look good.
Sorry.
Also, the world has changed. Shantanu, to take your point forward, it is now not possible, as Raghuram Rajan rightly says, it is not possible now to, be the manufacturing hub of the world, that China became at that point of time. The world, what has also changed post-COVID is that globalization is now RIP for the moment. So, now it is more about, wanting to have your own supply chains, within the country, wanting to promote now with Trump coming in, is going to increase even more, saying America first, et cetera. So considering the current reality, it is now not possible for anybody to aim to be the next China. That was a time, when they, pulled off what they did. At this point of time, that also is a challenge that the world is not so much welcoming of foreign goods coming in. And borders are increasingly getting, guarded and taxed. WTO is also gone now. Effectively now, what is going to happen is that if Trump goes ahead and puts this tax on Chinese imports, and what he's talking with Mexico, with Canada, etc. So effectively, WTO has gone, and now free movement of goods and services and people US also is no longer the country that welcomes immigrants and takes them in with open arms. Europe tried to welcome the wrong people and is paying a price. So, you know, considering where the world is, India still is in a good place. So, after all this, the reality is that this growth isn't bad when you put it in the context of what's happening across the world. It is just that we know that our potential growth is between 8 to 9%, and you know, with this, some of the self goals that we keep hitting puts this growth at a lower print. So the frustration, you know, is that you know, we think that we can do much better and we should do much better, but some of the things that we don't do right, you know, puts us below the possible level of growth. But relatively, we are still good.
No, that's a lovely thought, Aseem. I just wanted your view on this slide. I mean, this and similar slides we keep seeing. Because see, as entrepreneurs, you're right, we have to be optimistic, right? We are building for the next 10 years. Venture investors are investing for the next 10 years. And broadly, what keeps us excited is charts like these that say that, hey, and because you specifically mentioned, right, we should not, it's going to be difficult to build the next China. And I keep debating this. I've been hearing India is the next China for the last 15 years. And everybody still tells me that the next 15 years, India will become the next China, right? Do you think this is possible, or what's the risk to this happening? Let's look at this. Because, see, every potential entrepreneur, current entrepreneur, maybe VCs who are listening to this, are basically doing what they do because they believe that this chart will come true. Do you see potentially what is the risk for this not happening?
You see, in my past life, I worked in the stock market, and one thing I learned there is sell anything which promises to be the next anything. So you can always be the best whatever you are. You can never be the next anything. You know, that never works.
Yeah.
The reality is that anybody who studies economics too much will end up getting depressed, because all intellectual thought always leads you to negativity. So, you know, when thinking becomes too deep, you may be right in your thinking, but you will be wrong in your behavior outcome post that. The reality is that, when India always has this strange dance of two steps forward, one step backward, you know, we Gujaratis call it garba, you know, so... we have this unique dance, you know, and which is why foreigners find us very difficult to understand. But the reality is that two steps forward, one step backward also means one step forward. So we will you know, as it is always said about India, is that we consistently prove both the optimist and the pessimist wrong. You know, so we are never as good as sometimes we appear to be, and we are never as bad as sometimes we appear to be. The reality is that you know, we on the balance, you know, when you look at situation, you know, if you are building a business today, how should you look at it? The reality is that two things you have to keep in mind. One is that don't worry about all these broad economics numbers. These are not in your control. What is in your control is that, can you today build a great product at great pricing, and do that consistently for decades? If the answer is yes, you will build something of value. Too much worrying about all these macroeconomics, this, that, etc., which is why there is no record of a great economist having built a great business. So sometimes, you know, these numbers are good to keep in perspective, but they shouldn't be the overdriving factors on which you build your business. Now, you know, for example, if you are today looking at Bombay Shaving Product. Now, the question is that, you know, how should you look at the market? Probably the way to look at the market is that the India 3 actually wants the best product, but is struggling to afford it. Can we make something that gets them there? They also want it, you know, but, you know, how do you reach them? How do you put it at the right price point? Is the question scale? Is it that at scale you can put it at the right price point? Then you need to invest in that scale and go after that, you know, that dream. So effectively, all your products, until they are competing only at India 1 price points, you know, and you know, whether it's in airports or whether it is in, you know, in big shops, you will find it a different go. But can you approach it differently by saying India 2 and India 3, you approach it differently? For example, in our business, we don't do metros at all. We are not there in any of the metros. We go in Tier 2 and Tier 3 towns. And you know, we will also eventually go into deeper. For example, even in Uttar Pradesh, you know, there are 60 districts. You know, we are now wanting to penetrate almost all of them. Eventually. So the answer is that if you look at great companies, they have solved for distribution at the right price point. And they did it in that day and age in a way in which they had to be done, like a Parle-G, what it achieved, or a thumbs up what it had achieved. Was wonderful in those days where connectivity was what it was. Today, the channels have changed, etc. But still, you know, if you are able to get your product to the customer at the right price point, and it's a good product, you will build a good business. So whether it's a product or a service, I would say that don't focus too much about these numbers. Just get down to building something good. India is a wonderful place to build a business. I would not want to do it anywhere else right now.
What Aseem seems to be indicating is like the same for what we, you know, obsess over these days, health matrices, so Apple Watch matrices and Whoop. You know, while you keep measuring them, you can't do much, about improving them, et cetera, et cetera, or they're not the whole thing. The same, I think, with the economist, predictions as well. These are good barometers to keep looking at, okay, are we improving, not improving, but, you know, don't read too much into it.
You know, so Chirag, you know, if you actually see even about health, the reality is that the more you will see this, that people who measure it a lot actually end up worse off. So knowing every thing that happens in your body, is probably not even desirable. So if you actually see our grandparents and the way they lived, you know, that was the right way to live. You know, you have your two square meals in a day at home. I don't consume outside food. And clean water, clean air, and clean food is all we need. And all three we've ended up poisoning. So without that, you know, and completely, I mean, the walking has gone out. That generation used to walk. It didn't have a problem walking 10 minutes to save 10 rupees. Today it's exactly the reverse.
Maybe at some point of time, we should discuss Brian Johnson, who has been measuring his body, you know, left, right, top to bottom, inside out. What does that mean?
I'm not a big believer. Fundamentally, personally, I am on Aseem's side of this. I think the more you measure, the less. I don't know whether those bionic markers and this and that actually make sense. In fact, Aseem, to your earlier point, should we make products for India 3 at a price and still make money? I think that's such a valid point. In fact, I've just sent you guys a WhatsApp image of our latest launch. I can't share what it is, but it is we are making per SKU price of 75 paise, and we'll probably make a 15% margin on that. So you can imagine the per SKU price for a retail consumer is under a rupee or slightly more than that, which is something Bombay Shaving Company would never have done 5 years back. But that is where we are, and we have taken that bet. We have decided to make it in India. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs will have to do that. I actually wanted to come to a second question. I know we are kind of slightly running out of time, but I do want to ask this question because a lot of the lives that maybe Revan, Chirag, me, we are probably in our late 30s, early 40s. A lot of our lives are lived because our parents were able to migrate the economic strata very quickly and very easily, right? There was a dream that even if you are born in post-independent India at a lower income household, one or two generations of education, stability of jobs, and kind of good productive career, whether it was in banking, manufacturing, IT, whatever it was, could take you to a level where which you could kind of migrate the economic strata. And I think that dream is very important for India 2 and India 3. But the more, and you made a point earlier in the conversation, around 2,500 families kind of gathering. The way someone had explained it to me was, imagine a pile of coins on a table, and 2,000 families kind of take the pile of coins for themselves, and whatever falls off is there for the remaining 140 crore people, right? But if that continues to be the case, migration across economic strata will become a pipe dream. And if that dream starts fizzling out, then productivity will automatically come down because people will be like, what's the point of this anyways? And we have to, like, I think everything that we do as entrepreneurs, as financiers, as citizens, I think is to make sure that that dream stays alive and that we continue to make examples out of people who kind of are able to do well. But I just want to get your thoughts on whether it is harder today, it is easier.
So I have a question. Keep all the statistics we discussed on one side and answer this, that do you know of anybody, how many people do you know whose next generation has done worse than the previous generation at any level of economic strata?
Super rich. Super, super rich.
Correct. So only, like only where you are at the top fall is possible.
Correct.
But when you are at the bottom, you are only going to rise. So every generation will fight its way. It will have its struggle. It will have its frustrations. It will have its quarrels. But today, are every generation today better off? I mean, look at a security guard. Now, a security guard, working in any premises, earlier, do you know that the guy used to go home once on a Chhat Puja or something, once he would go home? He would not even be able to, the STD costs were so high that he would not even call home. Now, with mobile phones and with, video calling, etc., he doesn't feel so distant, from his family that he used to be. If you speak to people, you will realize that where their parents were versus where they are. I have not yet met anyone who is not better. I mean, there could be different levels of struggle, but who is not better than what their parents were. So that is progress. Now, that progress, could it be mean that they will move from India 3 to India 2 to India 1 as we would like to do in our Excel sheets? That is not going to happen. But, will the average level of income keep getting pushed up over time? The answer is yes, certainly it will.
Absolutely. Unless there is, for example, I was reading an article about Punjab, for example, where the next generation, because of the drug issue, etc., like the 40-45-year-old Punjab resident with a 20-25-year-old child today, for example, is tremendously worried about exactly this, that will the next generation live a worse off life than us because... it's a very externally driven issue. But Europe, for example, now people are saying that, our parents lived a better life than us. And I really hope that we don't reach that point where, the next generation actually feels like our parents lived better.
Isme ek hi, I think, big change can happen, Aseem, is while I agree with your point that the last 100, 200, 500 years have shown that except for the people who are on top, everybody else has lived a better life in that sense, right? Or at least they have moved stratas, economic stratas. I fundamentally think this was before the internet age. What is happening with the internet age is people's minds are being programmed in a very different way. I actually worry a lot about today's 20-year-old, even though they may be okay. Let's take India 1 kids, right? Let's say my kid who's 9 years old today. 10 years later, he'll be 19. His ability to be productive, independent, and I'm sure he'll live a very different life because he'll have access like no other, right? Everything will come in 10 minutes or 5 minutes, or there'll be a button and things will just appear and stuff like that. But what will he spend his time on, right, is being programmed not by me as a parent, but earlier it was parents, teachers, let's say school friends, etc. But the internet is shaping behavior in a very, very, very different way. And I think there is a very distinct trend I am seeing where people's, just go back to what we started with, people's aspirations are going faster than their ability to actually solve for those aspirations. It's getting worse because the internet's just creating those aspirations and making it highly likely that you will continue to be in this trap forever. Because that's what, by design, every product that has scaled well does, right? Why does Netflix proudly say that our enemy is sleep? I mean, the fundamental thing that you require for good health is good sleep. And there is a business which is, $500 billion in valuation, which is saying that our enemies sleep and we are all celebrating. Great, amazing. Let's buy the stock even more. I mean, the Netflix culture book is, revered amongst all startup founders saying, yaar, aisa dhanda banana hai karke. Like, see what we are celebrating. I'm not saying it's a bad business. I myself really like the way that they have built their culture. I respect that business. But by design, if you see the socio-economic impact of the kind of businesses we are building, And where this will end up as second, third order effect 20 years down the line, I think we are actually going to be in for a big surprise.
Well, Dikki, I don't know whether you've seen, ironically, on Netflix, there's a documentary called Buy Now, The Shopping Conspiracy. If you have not watched it, do watch it. It made me question existentially why I do what I do. Because not only socioeconomic outcomes, Revan, also climate outcomes. We don't realize the amount of plastic we are creating and how, for example, how badly it'll affect our enough, far more than it's affecting us today. Sorry, Asim, I interrupted you.
No, every generation, I mean, if you see the behavior of generations across time, then, you know, they've been labeled in such a way, you know, that whether there is a boomer generation or whether it's starting from the lost generation to the boomers, to the X's, etc. So the ethos, you know, and the world keeps changing, world keeps evolving. And every generation has always looked back and said, in our times, it was much better. We worry about the next generation. You know, I don't, if you look at the history of human generations, there's never been a generation that was comfortable, you know, with the new generation while they were growing up. There was a hippie generation, et cetera, that, you know, you thought they has totally lost it almost, you know, from the previous generation's viewpoint. So there are two ways to look at it. One is that, yes, you cannot reverse change, you know, so what is there is real, and the outcomes of that will be what there are, and the children will find their way. You know, for example, the history of internet tells you that when internet first comes in the hands of people, it is used for wrong things. And over a period of time, you know, the graduation happens and then you'll use it for education and for skill development over time. So it starts with the wrong things, moves to entertainment, and then moves to more productive things, you know, that are helping you, understand what's happening in the world and see and find, make your space within that. So the reality is that the new generation will adapt. But that doesn't take away the fact that humans have totally lost the plot, and also that is given. We are the stupidest species that has lived on this planet, which basically is destroying it while we are sitting on it. And now, and instead of making Earth better, we are trying to figure out if Mars is livable. I mean, if you look at clothing, 100 billion. Clothing units get sold in a year.
It is crazy.
What is the logic?
And one of the most celebrated companies in the world, Shein or whatever, it's crazy. I think they launch 1.3 million styles a year or something bizarrely high. So, yeah, I agree with you.
My biggest takeaway from this last rank was how porn is supposed to be wrong thing.
But OnlyFans is one of the most successful businesses you would predict.
I just saw the results.
Crazy.
The biggest OnlyFans creator makes about 40, 50 million in a year compared to what most sports stars would not get, right? So I'm sure it's a legit way to build business. But I like the way you labeled that internet was used for the wrong things first and then fundamentally we figure out a way over time. But to be fair to Elon, I mean, he does, I mean, Tesla, Solar City, etc. I mean, the climatic impact of EVs is by design all been led by Tesla, right? So while he's trying to figure out, I think it's his backup plan. Like, we'll try to fix the world, but in case it's not fixable, I mean, he's got the US elections also done, right, in that way. So he's trying to fix the world, but while he's trying to fix the world, backup plan is we'll go to Mars.
No, I think the idea is to collect all the waste in the world and put it on Mars. The idea is not to take humans there, take all the waste we're creating, put it there so that Elon SpaceX also gets business, and we're kind of all happy with it. This has been such an insightful discussion, Asim, as always. I know Revan Chirag, I don't know whether you guys have interacted with Asim before. I have, like, on a very educative podcast before, and I
watched the podcast. I really saw it. Yeah. So it was. I mean, I think the best advantage of the internet is now you get to know a person a little bit when you see long form content, right? So it's like I have known you, Asim, for a while after seeing you on the podcast.
I enjoyed yours as well. You know, so that, yeah, you're right. You know, I knew of you even before meeting you today. So that is an advantage.
And also Aseem's Monday mornings, I actively come and look for that. And by the way, Aseem, I don't know whether you know this, but people now actively look for you on LinkedIn. You don't just show up in someone's feed and people enjoy it. There is a demand that is very, very, it's not latent demand, it's active demand now, which is people now actively look for. And it's so good to see you kind of put your thoughts out. You can see that, I think you can take all the stuff that you have written over a period of time, compile it into a book, and kind of it'll be one of the best books in the shelf behind you also, because it's so valuable. But thank you for
it. It is coming, by the way.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. A friend is putting it all together.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, I cannot wait. But guys, I know we have kind of, Chirag, Revanth and I have been thinking that how do we make sure we stick to an hour? I think given the insight density of this discussion, I think we've done a very good job over the last hour. I think let's spend 5 minutes on any closing thoughts, anything that is on top of mind, whether it's about India's consumption and growth story or, the test match that's going to come up this week as well. Any other stuff that is on your mind that's happened this week, that's going to happen next week?
I'm very excited with the Chess World Championship going on. I don't think a lot of people watch chess.
What happened yesterday?
They drew. So it was game
4.
They're
2 each now.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't know if you watch chess, Haseem. Gukesh D is challenging Ding Liren from China for the Chess World Championship. It's a 14 games match. Shockingly, he lost the first one. I think it was nerves. He's 18 years old. It's his first World Championship. So, but I love the game 3 comeback. They drew the second. He won the third. So it's now. And now the fourth one was a draw, so it's 2-2. This weekend is going to be exciting. Game 5 and Game 6. I'm really, really looking forward to both those games. Hopefully, he at least wins one of them and gets into the lead. I think it's phenomenal. I don't know how many people have seen this, but India's on a tear in chess now. For the longest time, it was only Vishwanathan Anand. But I think now all of these kids, we have the world number 2 is Indian. World number 4 or 5 is Indian Gukesh. We have, I think...
Vidit is top 10, yaar. Vidit is now top 10.
I think that keeps oscillating.
Yellow, I think one month back, he was top 10 yellow.
Yeah. So I think the younger generation, which is Bukesh, Prag, Arjun is also not that old. He's 21, I think. So all of
Arjun is actually the least spoken about. He's the highest yellow rated guy, but he's the least spoken about amongst these three.
I think he's a little unpredictable. So people generally don't understand him well. I think the next few years are going to be far more exciting. We have a bunch of other kids in the 2600 ELO as well. So I'm super. I think if Gukesh wins, we're going to see like 10 more years of a lot of people getting into chess, and which is, good, right? We invented chess. It's high time we dominated the sport. Like we should have. I think it's high time we did that. So super excited for that.
I actually want Gukesh to win just to see Magnus kind of take a reputational beating on his predictions.
I don't think he cares. I don't know. Like, I've been watching chess now for the last 2-3 years a lot. He's technically semi-retired already, right? So, and see, he is the greatest of all time. Even Kasparov admits that. So,
by a distance, I think now.
So, he's more focused on business building now. I don't know if you know, he's bought chess.com. He's multiple new apps. Like, he's building an empire out of this, and he just plays for fun now. So,
he's a Elon of chess, I think.
इंटरेस्टिंग है ना ये कि एक आइकॉन बनता है एंड देन द नेक्स्ट जनरेशन इज अबाउट यू नो फॉलोइंग दैट इट हैपेंड इन क्रिकेट इट स्टार्टिंग टू हैपन इन बैडमिंटन इट स्टार्टिंग टू हैपन इन चेस आई वाज ऑलवेज अम्यूज्ड कि इंडिया में बॉलर क्यों नहीं आते आई थिंक बुमराह शुड लीड दैट टू गेटिंग मोर बॉलर्स ऑल्सो नाउ आई वॉज ऑलवेज अम्यूज्ड कि यार पाकिस्तान से सारे बॉलर आ जाते हैं इंडिया में वाई डू वी नॉट गेट बॉलर्स बट आई थिंक दैट शुड ऑल्सो चेंज
I used to be so upset with the right arm medium fast. And where is our right arm fast, right? For a while, Zahir Khan was there. Again, Munaf was there. He went away. But now we have Shami, Bumrah. These are like regular bowlers hitting 140, 145 clicks. It's just awesome.
No, it's nice. I never thought while my son's into cricket, I always thought it would be like, initially he said Virat, Rohit, yeh, but now everywhere where he goes, people ask him, who's your favorite cricketer? It's like Bumrah. So it's good, right? That kids also have... You're right. It's about media exposure. And I actually wrote a thesis around it. It's all about media exposure. See, like...
Who's your icon? Who's your
icon? Icon is who gets more talked about. द मोर प्रेस कवर्स इट, लाइक वाई इज दिस बिग ग्राउस अगेंस्ट क्रिकेट, राइट, कि यार बाकी स्पोर्ट कवर ही नहीं होते हैं करके, आप कवर करो अपने आप बच्चों उसमें भी घुसेंगे करके, ऐसा नहीं है कि नहीं घुसेंगे, बिकॉज देयर माइंड्स आल्सो गेट शेप्ड वेरी अर्ली विद दिस, राइट, वेयर इज द मनी, वेयर इज द फेम, आई मीन दीज आर थिंग्स दैट इवन यंग किड्स अंडरस्टैंड वेरी क्विकली.
India ko from a cricket perspective, India needs their own Glenn Phillips. You saw his catch yesterday.
Crazy. Dude, that guy, I've been following him. I don't know, but I Paul Collingwood and Glenn Phillips, I will go to a stadium to just watch these two field.
Yeah, maybe Jonty Rhodes League. Like maybe even better. Yaar. Yesterday's catch was insane.
I think Jonty was, compared to the baseline of that era, Jonty was good, but Glenn Phillips is off the charts, yaar. Off the charts.
I can't even imagine that guy playing the test match, but I think I would play him the test match only for his fielding.
100%.
He'll just pull off something which is insane.
In T20, for example, he will save 6 to 7 runs above the average fielder and take the one-off catch. And that's better than a 150 strike rate and 25 batting average in my view.
I'm at the other extreme. I don't watch television at all. So, you know, normally when Indians say they're interested in sports, you know, that means they're interested in watching sports. If as many were interested in playing it, we would have been a much better country. You know?
When I play chess. Unfortunately, I don't play it well. So, like, aur gussa aata yaar, haarte ho, fir lagta hai ki yaar isse kyun haar gaya karke main, fir chhodo yaar, let me get back to work.
But Asim, Chirag Sankhriday is now like an up and coming top cricketer at his age, I think he's now 9 or 10, 9 years old now, Chirag?
Now 11.
Now 11. Now, but he's playing in the under 14 leagues of Bangalore. So
lovely.
We have a cricketer in this room for sure. And I don't know. I think chess. I think he changes passions now and then.
Oh, he's 9. He keeps figuring out what is the next most exciting thing. We'll see.
So now IPL auctions begin at 13.
Well, I have a strong feeling that 13, given the age restrictions in that part of the country, I think a 13 is possibly a 15. But I don't know if you saw that interview with Virendra Sehwag and someone else. Under 19, ke safe pe khela tha apne. Sehwag, yaar, this toh I think chade jaa tha. Ke under 19 khela tha, aapki over cup kitni thi us time pe? 19 thi. Usse nahi actual over. He's a no holds barred guy. Absolutely no. IPL, what an. I don't know why they did it in Jeddah of all places, but there is some signaling there, right? There's US World Cup, then there's Jeddah IPL auctions, then there is this whole. I don't know whether you guys watched the commentators discussing the auctions the next day. They were talking about the $1 million man, the 20 crore man, and Rishabh Pant this. It was so commercial. And I think, again, I think Arunav and Kriday will be watching that and thinking, cool, this is where I want to be. And again, IPL is so cool, right? And suddenly from 15, an India squad of 20 players maybe, we now have 10 franchises with a squad of 30. So now suddenly 300, 350 players are playing cricket, making money, of which, maybe half are Indian, getting access to global superstars. So the Indian contingent gets better and better.
But who made the most in the auctions?
Rishabh Pant only, I think.
Wrong answer. Think again.
Oh, the owners of the franchise, these guys.
No. They paid. Who won the most? Indian Income Tax Department, 120 crores.
Oh, no. I have another drop in the inflation book.
Without putting the pads on.
That is true. Government is always there. But yeah, City, any final thoughts? I know you have a flight to catch. I don't know why you take Saturday flights, yaar.
Oh, don't ask me. I think very insightful discussion. A lot of takeaways, from India 1, premiumization to Asim enlightening us that India 3 is a bucket where great pricing strategy should be worked upon. How we should look at, I think, for me, data in respect to microfinance and some of those things adding up and showing up in terms of, okay, where are we feeling the pain? I think the big question for all of us to answer is, which keeps coming back, while we continue to see those Excels and dream machines go on, will India again throw it away? Right. The answer is, you know, is that well, we continue to add, you know, our bits in terms of building our businesses and be very optimistic. Government will do their part in terms of ensuring, you know, monetary policies are acting to, you know, continuing to grow GDP. Hopefully, you know, what Aseem said, we should have a CRR cut coming our way. But a lot of takeaways for me. Thanks, Aseem, for coming and, you know, doing this with us.
Thank you. Thank you. And from my side, closing comments is anybody listening to this, all data on one side, every good business is built by identifying an opportunity and then executing on it. So don't drown in too much of data. I know it's all nice to know, nice to have, you know, et cetera, but there is nobody called India. All of us together, you know, will determine the future of India. So if each one of us does the best, you know, we can, India will have a great future, no doubt.
Oh, excellent. Thanks a lot, Aseem. At least I have got my punchline for my next board meeting from today's discussion. I'm playing Garba. Two steps forward, one step.
Two Gujarati in Revat has woken up this Saturday morning. Two steps forward, one step back. No, I think Aseem is just phenomenal. Every interaction with you has been superb. And I really hope that, you know, and you're right. I think someone told me this, that if macro factors start affecting your business, that means you are too successful for macro factors to matter anyway. So I think for all entrepreneurs, just kind of opportunities are always there. And India, and I think the long story remains solid, I think, as long as we are able to navigate the short and medium term difficulties. I think that's my big takeaway from today. So Aseem, thank you so much, sir. Thank you so much for taking time. And by the way, I think I speak on Revant and Chirag's behalf that I think we would love to have you on Asymmetric regularly whenever your schedule permits. We will cover topics from, you know, public markets to startups, business, tech, consumer, banking, etc. And every time, like, we might just kind of overstay our, you know, kind of welcome with this one and kind of get you here a lot more and kind of be a burden on your calendar, but we would love to have you on Asymmetric a lot more.